Good afternoon. This is Ann Holland over at Marketing Sherpa. I'd like to thank you for joining us for our annual teleconference on business-to-business marketing. We will be presenting our latest brand new research on lead generation, nurturing, and conversion stats and tactics specifically for the marketing department. Joining me today is our research director, Stefan Tornquist. Hey, Stefan.
Hey there, Ann.
Now, everybody who's listening in, you should have received via email, actually in the same email that you got this phone and number from, there would have been a hot link to your PDF presentation. If you haven't opened that and printed it out or opened it on your screen, go ahead and do that now. If for some reason you've lost the email, no problem. Call over or email over to our service department. That's service@marketingsherpa.com. Or you can call 1-877-895-1717. And they will flip you a copy of the presentation. Yes, you can share this presentation with your coworkers and print it out, no problem. All that we ask is that you don't cut it into pieces or, you know, lift part of it for something else. Just go right ahead and use it as a whole. Now, Stefan, can you talk us through quickly where did we get the data that we're going to be presenting today? I know you did a whole bunch of different studies that all kind of combined into one.
Sure. Well, our principal source of primary data is our annual survey of business technology marketers. This year we surveyed over 1,000 of them. And we also coupled a number of surveys of end users, whether that's end white paper recipients or business executives who make technology decisions. All told, we surveyed over 4,000 end users. In addition, we conducted a number of lab tests and partnered pieces of research. And that doesn't mean that someone paid us to conduct a study. That means that we partnered with them because they had some ability to either look at a unique audience or bring a unique way of analyzing the data to the picture. Beyond that, we also look for the best of data that's out there, places that that can fill in the gaps. Some of that has been published in other places, but a lot of it has been made available exclusively to Marketing Sherpa. And finally, we use the case studies and interviews to provide sort of a context around those numbers.
Okay, cool. So, and actually, I think that 4,000 number of business-to-business prospects is one of the largest surveys of B2B prospects that's been done. I think it's the largest we ever did.
Well, in truth, that's a number of different surveys, and I'm sort of bundling them together and not taking the time to describe them each individually. But all told, that's quite a big number.
All right. So we talked to you and your peers. We talked to your prospects, and we did a lot of lab tests. Now, what did we learn? If you would join me to move forward to page number 4 of the presentation. First of all, and this is interesting, this is kind of a change from last year, we asked you and your peers in the marketing world what your biggest challenge was when you are marketing IT services, software, and hardware to the business community. We said, what's the hardest thing right now in your job? And what's interesting was last year, most people were talking a lot about the lengthening sales cycle because, let's face it, sales cycles have been getting longer for a lot of folks for a while now, well over a year. In terms of length, depending on the product. But instead, this year, we heard something different. Stefan, can you talk us through?
Sure. Well, their primary concern this year really had to do with the growing number of people involved in that ever lengthening buying process. And the way I interpreted that was to mean that it's demanding to fill the content needs for all of these disparate buyers. You've got tech folks with very specific questions, business folks who want to know how the technology is going to work in their daily lives, and of course the financial and decision-making folks who want to know how much it's going to cost, what are the customer service implications, et cetera.
And of course, if you have a growing number of people on the prospect side that you have to influence, all the rest of the challenges fall right in line, because if you've got to influence, you know, 18 different decision makers and influencers, then you've got to manage multiple lead generation campaigns across multiple media to all those different kinds of people. And you've got to do PR buzz that, you know, you don't know what different people will read and where they're going to read it. So each extra person on the committee becomes a bigger marketing challenge for the rest of your challenges. Why don't we move on to what prospects say? Is it true? Are the committees really getting bigger? And guess what? It is true. So it is not just your perception that suddenly now it's a lot harder to sell, especially sell into the enterprise. It is the reality. These committees on the prospect side of decision makers and influencers are getting bigger and bigger. Stefan, can you talk us through how we got this data?
Sure. Well, in as you see, along the bottom are the sizes of various companies, and there's a very regular increase. As those companies get bigger, so do the committees that contribute to the decision-making process. One of the things that this did was encourage us to do a lot of our survey research this year, splitting out those decision-makers, the finance, CIO, level folks, versus all of the contributors to the process, the many people that do research and put technology through its paces during that buying process.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I should mention is that depending on the type of purchase, these numbers may vary. For instance, if you are looking at a highly technical purchase that really only the tech team is going to deal with, something like a data warehouse, for instance, or backup storage, you're probably dealing with a smaller group. That's it's a core technology appraisal group, and then a couple of people from finance and the CIO. It's those projects that involve multiple business units, take CRM, for example, that's really going to have a really large number of contributors.
So the nightmare is here. You are marketing to the committee, and you have to reach everyone on the committee. And, of course, that makes me think immediately about white papers. It's one of the primary ways, among many, but one of the primary ways that B2B technology marketers are generating new leads and evangelizing their product to the world. Plus, of course, educating those committee members that are often not technology, often they're more from the business end. So you have to educate them in what is all this technology, why are we different, why do you need it? I mean, there's so much need for the white paper in this sales process. And so, of course, we asked the end consumer of the white paper, you know, what are they thinking? Are they downloading white papers? Are they reading more or less? Is it harder or easier to get their attention with white papers these days? Stefan, what was the main takeaway from the questions about white papers?
Sure. Well, if we move on to slide number 5, you'll see their answer to one question.
Mm-hmm.
And this was, for those people who are using white papers less frequently, why is that? And while most of the reasons are about on par, the one that busts it wide open is that they don't have to register or provide personal information when using alternative sources of information. And now the good news here is that, by and large, executives and contributors are using white papers as much or more than they did back in the 2005 through 2006 period. So the water is not running out of the drain on white papers, far from it. But there is a growing group of people who are saying, you know, I'm looking for alternatives. And the big reason they're doing it isn't because they don't like white papers per se. It's because of the hurdles that we make them jump through to get that information.
Yeah. Oh, another registration form.
Exactly.
That kind of feeling.
Exactly right. I think all of us have a grateful feeling when we click on a link and lo and behold, it's got PDF after it and you're immediately accessing the information you are interested in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were talking earlier about the size of that buying committee. If you want a piece of documentation to be easily circulated among all of those folks, you know, there's something to be said for having a very low barrier to entry.
So in other words, if you want your white paper to go viral across the committee, so people are handing it off to other people on the committee, which we know they do once they get it in their hands, if it's an interesting enough paper, if you want your white paper to go viral, you have to loosen the strings early on and get rid of those barriers. Just set the white paper free and then let it go and find its home and find its way across the committee. If the white paper is one that is critical, especially for educating that committee or nurturing that lead, where you really need everyone to have read it to make a good decision, hopefully in your favor, consider taking down that barrier for certain white papers. Now, Red Hat has actually been testing this for 2 or 3 years now, and we did do a case study on them and how they did that. And they said it was very successful, that they were getting out it was an exponential increase in the number of white paper downloads for certain white papers. And then, of course, they just had a call to action at the end of the white paper. If you read it and you were interested in them, then, hey, here's how you get in touch with us. And they said that made, to their mind, a profound difference. We actually have also tested this. If you go to our website and you click on the tab called Free Reports, you see a bunch of white paper downloads that are just, it's the direct PDF link. There's no reg form. We've done it both ways, and we found that, yes, we can absolutely track sales and track increased readership, all sorts of great things to just sort of setting the PDF free. So I think that this is something that is an interesting idea, especially, again, if you're marketing to a very large committee, this is something you really want to consider doing. The other thing that you want to consider doing is probably making sure your white paper is syndicated into websites where they have registered members, a high degree of registered members, because if you're a registered member on a website such as anywhere, you know, CNET, IT White Papers, CMP TechWeb, many of those other sites, you don't have to fill out the form to get the white paper. You're already registered. You're already logged in as a user, so you're more likely to download it. To you, you don't think there's a barrier, but the marketer still gets the lead or still gets the data. So it's another, definitely a star on the side of syndication. Always a great thing. Let's move on, of course, to our next slide, slide number 7, webinars. It's the sibling child of the white paper. Now, Stefan, this slide really freaked me out when I first saw it. In fact, I didn't think the data was right. It just was so extreme. Can you talk us through what these two different things are here on this slide about webinars?
Sure. Well, we asked those consumers of webinars, and again, that's the majority of the folks that responded to the survey do at least occasionally consume webinars, but we split that out by those people who play a decision-making role in the buying process versus those contributors I was talking about. And what we see, and yes, I went through the numbers more than once to confirm this, is really a profound difference in their consumption. And, you know, I don't think this difference would be so profound if you were looking at white papers, but when it comes to webinars, the deciders tend to be much higher, much more frequent consumers of webinars. Now, there aren't as many deciders as there are contributors, of course, but we see that 1 in 5 report that they attend on average a webinar a week, compared to just 1% of the contributors. And when you look at those people who say that they're very occasional consumers, you know, once in the last year, it's about a third of the contributors and only 7% of those decision makers. So clearly, whether it's you know, the ability to multitask while listening to a webinar, something about the medium itself, those folks who tend to be, you know, VP level, C-level business line managers, they really are much more likely to be avid webinar consumers.
And, of course, if you are someone listening to this, well, this is a teleseminar, but still, if you're listening to this today, you can put yourself in the higher level kind of personality there. What's interesting here is you're seeing a real difference between somebody who perhaps their job is more of a worker bee as opposed to someone who's more of that sort of thought leader, strategic thinker in the organization. It's a real difference. One of them is very much engaged in looking at the outside world, perhaps reading the Wall Street Journal, looking, you know, across to see what's going on, trends, forecasts, kind of bigger issues possibly. And then you have the worker bee who may be a contributor to the decision who's saying, well, you know, I'm busy getting my job done, but, you know, I don't have time for an hour right now. But if you, you know, if you have something shorter that I can grab and read whenever I've got a chance, I will. What this tells me is, number one, you might want to test different types of webinar titles. So you might say, okay, let's do more of a thought leadership piece for this webinar and test that for the decision maker. And then if we really do want the contributors, do a different kind of title for those people, or maybe fill that hole with the white papers with a slightly different angle to it. So consider angling your content for the different marketplaces within the committee. The other thing is, when you do a canned webinar, as so many of us are doing these days, I mean, you do your webinar live, and then, of course, you send out the little alert saying, okay, there's going to be a canned version coming out, and, you know, click here to see it, and then you add it to your online resource library, et cetera, et cetera. Consider chunking it. In other words, don't force the person who reviews the canned version to sit through the whole hour or whole half hour. Instead, put it up in such a way that they could just cut to the chase and get to the little bit that they're concerned about. Maybe they've been tasked by their boss, who is the vice president, to go out and get one piece of information or one factoid that will make a difference toward the decision, but they don't have time to listen to the whole hour. Maybe they'll go in there and they want to check out one particular slide, or maybe they want to hear one particular area of the webinar, and then if it really grabs them, they'll go back and check out other areas. There's plenty of technologies that allow you to do that now. We actually have tested that as well. In fact, just posting PowerPoint slides with an audio go ahead on top of it and letting people go and check different sections or just posting 10-minute increments or 5-minute increments tends to work very well. If you can't do that, if you want to do the low-tech version, you could just include a transcript online with your webinar. So if they don't have time to sit and listen to the whole thing, they can skim it through, pick out the section that really matters to them, and maybe read it. So consider the different ways you can serve up that content for the different type of information seeker. All right, let's move on to slide number 8, telemarketing, good old-fashioned telemarketing. Stefan, what does this mean, telemarketing still works? What did you ask these people?
Well, so this is a question that we asked of those people who said, yes, I have received a technology product-related cold call in the last, I think we asked about 6 months. So we asked those people what happened as a result. And as we can see, you know, quite a lot happened as a result. Now, to be clear, I don't think that these things necessarily come from a single cold call. If you note, something like 40% say that the vendor was invited to pitch their product in person. There's a pretty good chance that that didn't happen after one cold call. But what the cold call did was start the relationship, and mm-hmm. the relationship eventually resulted in that happening. So, yeah, it's absolutely an endorsement of good old-fashioned cold calling, especially when it's, you know, it's targeted and appropriate. We also, in the book, we go into a number of the factors that make cold calls appropriate versus inappropriate, how they're done at their best, and that, of course, makes a huge difference.
Now, of course, last but not least, it may not be a cold call. I mean, the prospect might have thought it was a cold call, but maybe a couple of months before that, they filled out a reg form somewhere, don't remember it.
You took the words right out of my mouth. I mean, one thing that we know from a lot of research is that most organizations aren't that great at following up a lead with necessarily a phone call within 24 hours. That phone call, especially if it's coming through a reseller of some kind, may come quite a long time after that initial lead. So in the minds of the end user, it seems like a cold call to them, at least some of the time.
Mm-hmm. So it still can work. It doesn't, you know, yes, you should follow up faster. And actually, we're going to have some new data on that this fall, so look forward to that. But in the meantime, you know, that the phone calls do work. We know they're expensive. We know that telemarketing is one of your most expensive methods, especially if you're doing it well with very well-trained reps, well-educated reps. But it's worth it. An inside sales department can really work. All right, let's move on to what may be to some people the most shocking slide of all in this presentation, slide number 9.
Yes, here. Despite all the work we do.
All that marketing.
All the marketing, the vast majority, and this really interested me, the vast majority say that when we ask them to think about a specific vendor that they had hired in the last 12 months, and the the vast majority said that they went out and found that vendor instead of the other way around.
It just isn't that hysterical. So here you are, killing yourself. You've got the trade show booth, you've got the webinar, you've got the white paper, you've got the banners, you've got the search marketing, you've got direct postal mail, you've got sales reps, and gee, that prospect just thinks he did all the work. Just gotta love it. The key, I think, from a marketing perspective here is not just to feel depressed and have, you know, good Lord, you don't want your CEO seeing this and saying, well, let's just cut the marketing budget by 80% because, hey, prospects are going to find us anyway. Heaven forbid they would say that. Really what you want to understand here is you need to be there to be found when they're looking. When they, you know, if they think they're in control of this process, let them be because they want to be, but make sure you are there ready to be found when they're looking. The biggest key that I draw from this is that means don't, if you have your big budget and you're going to do your big campaign of the year, consider not doing that. Instead of doing one big, you know, campaign of the year, I would break that budget up into 12 months and I would do a systemic cross-media kind of, it's low volume campaign that goes on year long, a year long presence in every possible media that those prospects are looking for you in. Whether it just be a text link, a syndicated white paper, a slice of a canned webinar, a smaller booth at niche shows, at regional trade shows, a direct mail campaign that repeatedly hits people, not the exact same campaign, maybe an ongoing progressive postal mail campaign to your top prospects who are in the perfect sweet spot for you. I mean, just how can you take all of your marketing and break it out through the entire year so that when they're ready to go looking, when they think they're going to look and find you, you're there. You're just right there in their hand. You just plop. It's like an apple falling right into their hand. You are the low-hanging fruit. It's no longer about the prospect being the low-hanging fruit. It's about you being the low-hanging fruit. And how do you manage it so you're there? It's got to be on their schedule, though, which means, again, break up your media buy. You can be smaller, but if they're looking, they're going to find you if you're using the right keywords, if you're positioned correctly, if you're, you know, addressing their pain points in your copy. They're going to find you. You don't have to shout and scream. They're looking, but you have to be there when they're looking. That is a real difference. It's kind of almost a Web 2.0 thing. Now, where do they look? Go on to slide number 10. Stefan, talk us through this data.
Okay, so what we did here was ask people initially, when you're in the early stages of the technology product research process, what do you do? What are the different sources you use? And as you can see, they're broken out to the right-hand side of the center axis. We see people say they always or sometimes use the various sources, and then rarely or never are there on the left-hand side. And, well, not surprisingly, search comes out on top, but what is surprising, unless you spend all of your time looking at numbers about the search industry, is the degree of dominance of Google as opposed to a couple of the other major consumer-oriented web search engines. The dominance here is really quite extraordinary, with 83% saying that they always use Google at some point in that early stage of the process. Now, under that, you have sort of the second tier, the IT vendor websites. Okay, no surprise there. Online IT pubs, also very strong, as are directories, corporate company directories, things like Hoover's, and IT community sites, all sort of in that roughly 60 to 70% usage range. And then you see a downturn at the analyst site. Not that there's anything wrong with analysts, of course, but
yeah.
Most people aren't members of analyst sites. They may not be subscribers, and they're much more likely to go to their IT community for answers. I think one of the Web 2.0 innovations has really just been to update something that's been happening in IT for a long time, which is especially those folks at the contributor level, when they're looking at, how much can this server really handle, they go to other folks who are in their position.
Mm-hmm. You go to your peers first, and then you go to the experts. It's sort of, I know in my real world life, I went to buy a new washer dryer last weekend. First, I talked to my neighbor who just bought one, and then I went to ConsumerReports.org. So I definitely, it was a 1-2 punch, but I went to my neighbor first. It's all about your peers. We all know word of mouth is the most critical medium for B2B marketing. It always will be, and it obviously is here as well. Now that they don't trust the analysts. The other interesting thing here, of course, is that directories number. As you said, that's people like Hoover's. And, of course, that means making sure your directory listing is updated, making sure they've got you right. Have they described your company correctly? If they're going looking, A, will they find you, and B, will they find you listed in the right way? This works for manufacturing, other types of B2B marketers as well. When they go to Thomas Net, are they finding you? When you go to Global Spec, are they finding you? When they go to regular association directories, are they finding you, and are you listed properly? If they read it, are they going to find, oh, yeah, this guy does what I want? What I think is interesting is when I talk to marketers about their directory listings in sort of a level of marketing sexiness fall down around the North Pole. I mean, they're just about as boring as you can be. I know people who are like, oh, yeah, we had the intern do that once a few years ago. I mean, it's just not something you're going and checking very often. You may be spending a whole lot of energy on your paid search listings and very little on, what do we look like on Hoover's? It's worth going and checking that, and it's worth bringing that up a little bit higher. And, what the heck, it isn't always that much work. It's just a quick look up to see what you look like and then find out how you can change if it doesn't match what you need to match.
And something worth remembering is that a lot of those directory pages show up quite high in the natural search rankings.
Yeah.
So, it sort of it feeds into
it's
that
a 1-2 punch.
Google number, yeah.
Yeah. Now, of course, as you can guess from that gargantuan Google number, the thing that really matters is your search marketing working in particular, search engine optimization. Now, this is on slide 11, and just to clarify for the few people who may not be aware of it, search engine optimization, known also as SEO, is getting your company and your web pages into the organic or natural listings. Those are the links that are free, as opposed to the paid listings, which are the ones that are usually at the top and running down the sides. So it's a very, it's a different kind of search marketing than PPC. Stefan, how did you get this information?
Well, we assigned a hapless marketing Sherpa analyst to look at the search rankings for 150 different enterprise and small to medium business technology websites.
Mm-hmm.
They're the same websites that we do our annual audit of. And what we did was look in their own company literature for key phrases, CRM, business information technology, that sort of thing. And based on what they put out as their core product set, their core business value, we then did searches and looked for where they showed up in the results.
Okay, so the keywords in your headline, maybe on your homepage, and then we looked up that keyword to see whether whether the search engine had noticed it on the headline in your homepage.
Exactly so. And one thing that differentiates the large from the small companies is that it's more common for the large companies to be bidding on and showing up in the natural search results for more generic terms, something like CRM, for instance. You know, that's a hotly contested piece of real estate on Google and all the other engines. Whereas the smaller companies, because they tend to be more niche focused, a lot of those search terms were two or three word terms, slightly more accessible real estate. So really, when you look at the comparison, they're actually doing pretty well, but it's for it's not Tribeca that they're trying to buy land in, to belabor the analogy. Now, one thing I should mention, when you look down at the bottom of the page and you see the second page natural results,
mm-hmm.
So some people show up there, and there are a number of studies out there that suggest that people will look at two or three pages of search results. It's our feeling that that's a bit misleading, because the kinds of searches where people will go deeper into the search tend to be a very specific type. For instance, a tech person is looking for, how can I configure Outlook for Server 2007, something very specific, and they're expecting to find a very specific answer somewhere deep in the results. If they're doing a more general search, I want to find a comparison grid of CRM software, for instance, I'm going to find multiple examples of that kind of thing in the very first page. So I wouldn't necessarily count on the second or third page really performing that well.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the good news is people are actually being found on the first page. The bad news is, even of the very large companies, 40% aren't anywhere on the first page of the thing they say they are the top company in. And for the smaller companies, that's, almost 60% are not being found on the first page of the thing that you're the top company in. And quite frankly, we've seen a lot of your budgets when it comes to search engine optimization. I can tell you, you're not spending enough. I'm not saying it's going to cost you a whole bunch, but I am saying if you're just depending on someone in the web department who thought he'd do it on the side as a favor to the marketing department, you're not spending enough. You do need to actually have a committee that's the search engine optimization committee. You do need to have your web department in on that meeting, and you do need to have hopefully somebody head in sales on that meeting, because I'm sure sales would like to see your name up there. And you need to press the point home and get a little help with fixing the website and fixing your inbound links so that you can get up there on that natural listing. It's so critical for all those prospects. Of course, you think they're finding you. Well, you kind of make sure you're there to be found.
Well, and we're constantly hearing about how rising keyword prices and the entrance of virtually all of the big brands into paid search marketing is forcing smaller bidders off of that first page. So, that only emphasizes the importance of being strong in your natural listings.
Mm-hmm. Now, once they come to your website, if they do come to your homepage, of course, we were wondering, is your homepage really set up in such a way that it's going to do a good job? The people who are likely to come to your homepage, maybe somebody who's heard of you once or twice, they may have seen an ad somewhere, or maybe they, saw a booth at the trade show, they ran into somebody from your company, maybe they were even word of mouth recommended, and they're like, oh, let me go find out about these people. Well, when our analysts went over and looked at your homepages, I got to tell you, they were struck by the unremitting sameness of them. In fact, if you look down at the chart on slide number 12, the chart on the bottom there, it shows you, we actually literally looked at both the large organizations and then the smaller companies and said, you know, what percent of these companies' homepages have this layout? And as you can see above there, there's a little wireframe that shows the basic layout. And it's amazing. I mean, you can go to IBM, you can go to Sun Microsystems, you can go to a bazillion different people, and all of them basically have that layout. It's, you know, slightly different billboard ad there, different headline, different little graphic, you know, different bullet points in the vertical columns. But basically, that seems to be the layout du jour for every B2B site out there that you could name. Is it a good layout? I mean, that's my next question is, well, is that because it's such a brilliant, amazing layout that's going to get people to register and get people to raise hands and get people to think you're the most wonderful company ever that, you know, that's the one to use? Well, we decided to study it. Is this really the best layout or not? And what we did was, and if you'll turn with me to the next page, which is slide number 13, you'll see an example of a before and after design. We actually took real live home pages. We took one from, I believe, IBM, and here's one from Sun Microsystems, and one from Oracle, as well as three from different smaller technology companies. And we tested, we did an eye-tracking test of what their current layout was, and then we just tweaked the layout a little. So as you see at the left, that's the real layout of the Sun Microsystems site when we did the test about a month ago. And then on the right side, you'll see our tweak. The exact same art, basically, the exact same words, the exact same hot links, the exact same colors. I mean, nothing changed. We just moved stuff around a little just to see, in this case, we wanted to see, does three columns work better than one, two, three, four columns? And that's a real difference. I mean, especially if you kind of move that billboard over a little bit so there's more navigational columns, information a little higher up above the fold. And what we found, indeed, and in fact for every single test we did, that the fewer columns tended to work a lot better than the multiple columns, and then, indeed, people tended to really prefer and find it easier to find what they were looking for when it was fewer columns and there were navigational items well above the fold and their view wasn't kind of blocked with this big ad in the middle. Now, if you'd like to get more information about this whole homepage study that we did, we have a whole 45-page homepage study with all the results and all the pictures of all these different real-life web pages and the way that we redesigned them. No problem. We're offering it for free, and you can learn more at the end of this presentation. Now, in the meantime, we also conducted eye-tracking studies on the most critical interior page of your site, and that, of course, would be the pages where you've got a registration form, where you've got a contact us form, where you've got a white paper form, anything where people are saying, yes, I'm going to fill in my information, and I'm going to become a lead for you. Stefan, this is on slide 14. Stefan, can you talk us through this slide?
Sure. Well, so what you want in general is for people to start their experience of the page in the top left corner and then move through that descriptive content on the left-hand side. And once they've fully digested that, then you want them to move up and look at the registration form and hopefully fill it out. And what we're seeing here is a page where that's exactly what happened. There's good movement and good separation between the two parts of the page. What we see in cases of bad separation is that it scatters attention. So if that registration form weren't so clearly the second column of the page or were more integrated, then people's eyes might go to the registration form sort of early in the process. They're not convinced about its value, and their attention scatters and they're gone. Let's remember that most people only give a landing page, you know, 4 to 8 seconds. So what do they look at in those first 4 seconds? Well, their eyes, certainly they do touch on the headlines, but what we found in numerous studies is that they go for the bullet points because they can just take a quick look at 3 or 4 bullet points and they can know, you know, is this for me, isn't it? There's a high level attention there. Other thing worth noting is that a surprising amount of attention goes to the biography of the speaker. If you look down the sort of lower third of the page, it's got
That's a lot of eyeball time for something that's that far down on the page.
It's far down on the page, and it's quite dense content.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I think you can see that the attention does sort of wane about halfway or two-thirds through that paragraph. I would suspect that either making it shorter or splitting that into two paragraphs might make people more likely to sort of finish that finish that paragraph. But one long paragraph does tend to burn through attention. So this is one of nine heat maps that are in the main report, not as part of the special report, that look at white paper and webinar description pages, library pages, and registration pages.
It's cool stuff. I know we'd all like to be able to tweak our form a little bit to get more people to register. I mean, if you went to all the trouble of getting them to that page, you might as well get as many as possible to sign up.
One other thing on this landing page is that it employs a best practice that most people are not brave enough to use, and that is that there is not really much in the way of external navigation, navigation that will take people away from the page. Once people are here, except for some links on the bottom and, of course, the home page link in the main title bar, there isn't a lot of menu navigation.
That's right. There's no left nav bar and there's no horizontal nav bar. Yep.
Exactly so.
That shows you they're not distracted. They're reading the copy. And why don't we move on to slide number 15. Once they've registered, whether they gave you their card at a trade show or they registered online, no matter how they did it, how are you then going to be nurturing the lead through that enormously long sales cycle? And I wanted to look this year at we look at some of the classic lead nurturing tactics, but we also wanted to look at some of the newer things and say, you know, are there other ways to get to people, especially beyond just boring old email? Of course, inside sales phone calls, what are the other things that you need to be aware of when you're trying to nurture these leads? And here are – these are results from different surveys of actual business prospects who said – and, of course, the first one is 64% of decision makers told us that they were viewing email sometimes or all the time on a mobile device such as a BlackBerry. Now, when was the last time you looked at the email that you're sending out, the email newsletter or different nurturing emails? When was the last time you looked at it on a BlackBerry? Probably never. Or if you did, how ugly was it? It probably was hideous. Very, very few that we've seen you could actually even read properly. So take a look at that. Maybe even, you know, get a little budget out there because you could get a marketing department BlackBerry for experimental purposes only, of course, you know, to view your creative on. And send yourself some of your own internal emails that you use for nurturing campaigns. Look at them, and then you're probably going to want to do a redesign because if you really want to influence those decision makers, it better look good on the mobile device they're viewing it on. The next thing, of course, is RSS. Now, Stefan, the general population is not madly in love with RSS, are they?
Well, if they are, they don't know it. I mean, I think we've probably all seen the figures that although something like 35% of the general public is using the general online public is using something like the Google News Reader, Yahoo News Reader, that sort of thing. They don't know that it's RSS, and I think something like 7% of consumers as a whole, you know, sort of know about the technology and are paying real attention to it as a technology. It's just a useful bit of their homepage in most cases.
But when it comes to business to business prospects, in particular in the IT community, they think that RSS is a nice thing to have. So, well, a little RSS feed button on a blog for consumers might not work because they don't even know what it is. If you're marketing, especially to the IT department, sticking that on there may actually get you some real readers. And that explains why folks like IBM are offering multiple RSS feeds for almost every kind of content they're offering. I know that some of the IBM developer community websites, I mean, they offer upwards of 40, 50, 60 different RSS feeds that you can sign up for because they know these guys just adore them and want one that's specially just to their needs, specified to the thing that they're developing in. So I would definitely go and take a look at that and reconsider it. I wouldn't just put it out as just alternate to just your general, you know, email newsletter. I would say, what can I give them via RSS that fits that particular format?
Absolutely. I mean, if nothing else, RSS can be a tremendous money saver if it can cut down on your customer service calls.
Oh, absolutely. Now, last but not least, of course, podcasts. Now, last year we had some data that showed that podcasts, as of last spring, really hadn't moved the needle for more than about like 2% of business technology buyers, and they weren't a huge influence. But now we're seeing a real difference here. Can you explain what the 78% is?
Well, it's unclear what a real difference it is because what we asked here was, have you ever listened to a technology-related podcast? So this isn't a question of, you know, people who are regularly using audio content. I don't know whether they are or not. This is the largest conceivable number when it comes to audio content because we said, have you ever listened to it. So there's a it's a big number, and that's why.
Okay. Now let's move on to our last official chart of the day, and this is the fun chart. This is the lead conversion rate. And now, Stefan, you have a lot of different charts about lead conversion rates, depending on what kind of marketer it is and how well they're doing. But in general, this is a very overall average one. What you can see here is the average lead conversion rate. And first, it's inquiries to qualified leads to prospects, and then prospects to sales. So those are kind of the three stages of lead conversion. And this is per 1,000 inquiries. And then you have people, the conversion rates of marketers who are actually using best practices. So there's average marketers, and then there's the marketers that are using best practices. Now, what kinds of best practices would these be, briefly?
Well, we actually had quite a basket of best practices that we applied to this question, but it might be something like, you know, having a formal lead scoring system that had been agreed on by sales and marketing, having a process by which sales can hand a lead back to marketing if the lead has gone fallow. I think there were seven different qualifiers that that we designated as best practices.
But the cool thing is, if you are doing all that extra work and doing best practices in marketing, the sales team ends up converting more sales. They're getting a 20% conversion rate. So the sales team has got to be happier, has got to be loving the marketing department, and has got to be out there, you know, politically helping you. I mean, in-house politics, just right there alone, they're saying, wow, we love these guys. They send us decent leads. We're willing to follow up on the leads. So it's not just more sales. It's possibly more in-house joy.
It's all about the scrubbing early on in the process. You can see that they're actually the inquiries to qualified lead rate among those best practices folks is actually lower. And it's in the later stages that they make up for that by moving through the process a bit better. But it's those 120 folks are that much more qualified than the 170 on the other side.
Now, this is actually a chart I would show to my CEO. And I would use it during budget season or when I'm being measured against my success record. Because if the marketing department is being held, if your major success metric is we got in a whole bunch of leads, or my goal for, you know, this quarter, this financial quarter, by, you know, June 30th, I have to have gotten in X number of leads, this chart shows you it's all wrong. Your goal should be I got in leads that converted well to sales. My conversion rate to sales, you know, I handed off really good leads to the sales department. That's got to be the number that's going to make the company more money and going to make sales happier than just a whole bunch of leads. But, of course, you got to be able to measure that. That means closed-loop measurement. There's more work involved, but it's worth it because the company will be making more money. So this is absolutely the chart. Out of all the charts in this presentation, I would walk down the hall and show to the CEO when I was fighting for budget and I was fighting for a closed-loop measurement system. Now, that said, of course, we've got lots more charts that will help you with that budgeting process in the actual book itself. And as you can see on page 17, there's a little picture of it along with the homepage redesign research study that you can get for free along with your copy. I'd like to thank you for joining us today for some of the highlights from this research study. And in particular, I'd like to thank our special guests, the Massachusetts Innovation and Technology Exchange Group, who also attended today's teleseminar. Thanks for coming, guys. You're just right up the street from us, so it's a pleasure to have local marketers on the line. And thank you so much, Stefan, for sharing this new research with everybody. As we said at the beginning of this, sure, you can share this presentation with your team, and we hope that you find it of real use. Thank you, and good afternoon.
Bye-bye.